Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Talking Business, a podcast produced in Melbourne, Australia. The podcast is available on the Acast app, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. Or you can get it at the Business Acumen website at www.businessacumen.biz.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I am Leon Gettler. My job is to review and monitor the week's news in business, finance and economics. I bring it all to you every week. This is episode number 26 in our series for 2020, and today's date is Friday, 31st of July. First, I'll be talking to Accommodation Association CEO Dean Long. The Accommodation Association is a peak industry body and represents close to 3,500 hotels and nearly 58,000 employees across Australia. They've been doing it hard during COVID-19. And I'll be talking to RMIT Professor Sinclair Davidson about Treasurer Josh Frydenberg's latest budget outlook. But now, let's talk to Dean Long.
You guys represent the hotels and motels and accommodation providers. They're right in the thick of it at the moment with COVID-19. Tell us about it.
Look, we're an industry that's been absolutely devastated. Looking at revenue decreases of between 75 and 85% across the city and regional areas. In a matter of 4 weeks, we went from occupancies of low to mid 90% to sub 10%. And there was a period there where the only guests in Australia were those that were doing the self-isolation programs. So it was an absolutely devastating period. But we are starting to see some green shoots on weekends, but it was a devastating start to the year.
Okay, you're also now doing self-isolation for incoming travellers and accommodating frontline workers as well.
Yeah, and there's some really exciting work that's going on in that space. One of the things that as an industry we're really proud of, that when we were asked to step up to help healthcare workers stay safe, to support their families, and also to keep the community safe at the request of government, we were able to provide facilities that enabled that protection to take place. It's been a little bit disappointing to see some of the lapses in the government processes in Victoria. But in every other jurisdiction, it's worked fantastically well and we've played our role and really done our national duty through this process.
There were some issues with the security guards, weren't there, Victoria?
Yeah, it was quite an interesting approach. A lot of other states and territories utilised the Defence Force personnel and really ramped up the local police presence in each of those. Victoria chose a slightly different tact and looked at employing private security guards, and they did, and it definitely appears that that has been a source of the local outbreak in Victoria. But we are in the middle of a judicial inquiry in that, so we've got to see where that goes. But we do look forward to seeing what that finds. But I think the really critical element on this is the hotels weren't running the programs. This was a government-led program. It was a government-led process. That's their processes they've got to review and manage.
How was a hotel handled?
Look, the majority of them effectively turned their hotels over to the Victorian government. And governments across Australia. So it wasn't just in Victoria. And they went, right, this is the facilities that you need. These are the number of rooms that you need. All right, we'll be there to provide support services to those that are providing the frontline services. So we would be there to ensure that the staff were adequately trained on fire protection procedures, the evacuation procedures of the hotel, if that's what happened. We were there to support the check-in processes of those people that were part of the self-isolation process. But if it was delivering food, if it was servicing those guests, it was all done by external contractors managed by those state and territory governments.
Well, that would say there's a critical importance of the government and the sector have to really work closely together. It says that, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I think what it showed is in seven of the eight jurisdictions, it worked really well. And I think for the overwhelming majority of cases in Victoria, it also worked very, very well. But there were a couple of instances where, unfortunately, those that were employed by the government in that jurisdiction, they didn't follow the government's own processes or systems. All those systems and processes weren't in place by that government. So the judicial inquiry will show some additional information on that, and we look forward to engaging with that as it unfolds.
Well, this is all very unprecedented. We've never been through this. And so, while people can be critical of the way different governments have handled it, they're making it up as they're going along because it's all very new for them, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that nobody involved with the development of the self-isolation program with hotels went in with the wrong intention. This isn't a witch hunt. It's just we need to get to the bottom of what happened. So if this does happen again, we know exactly what went wrong so we don't make the same mistakes again. And that goes on both sides of the equation. Like the hotel industry will probably be far more stringent in what they request from government in their processes and systems. So they're comfortable that they've got the right protections in place. And I think government will be very, very, very clear and very, very certain to not make the same mistakes that have been made to date. So it's definitely a partnership in that, and everybody will get better through this process.
One of the big issues, of course, is in the healthcare sector. There's a lot of healthcare workers are now very vulnerable and have actually contracted the virus. I would imagine people in the hotel industry would be just as vulnerable to this as well. And they would be risking their health to do this work. Would you agree with that?
Probably not to the same extent as those that are operating on the front line in a health environment in those hospitals. There's definitely chances, as in the whole of community, where there is some chance of transmission. But we haven't seen that be the case of hotel staff to date in any of the countries or any of the states or territories that have been operating that program. And I think that also brings into the fact that a lot of the hotels have implemented really stringent safe guidelines for their staff about how to interact in these environments. And that's right from the front of house to those that are cleaning their rooms, making sure they've got the correct PPE. But I think there was a fantastic quote by a New South Wales government minister, and it said, this disease, it's not a long jumper, it's not a high jumper, and as long as you practice really good hygiene and really good safety measures, you're not going to get it. And I think that's a really important thing to recognise in this pandemic.
That's actually quite true. But I mean, I would imagine there'd be a lot of learnings for the hotels because this is so unprecedented. And I imagine there'd be a lot of lessons that come out of this.
Absolutely. I think the lessons are going to be enhancing what some of those systems and processes already were. We already know that hotels were a safe place to stay. They have higher hygiene standards than those that are operating in the unregulated space. And we've already seen that from all the hotel groups around Australia. They've increased their cleaning standards. They've increased the number of times rooms are inspected. They've increased the ability of staff to service those rooms in terms of time limits for each space. And I think we're going to see that ongoing because what travellers are going to be looking for now is a safe, secure tourism experience. And that's what the hotels will continue to build on.
So how do you expect the hotel industry generally will be different as we emerge from this?
I think what we're going to see is probably an investment in technology. I think we saw some really great moves out of the aviation sector over the last probably 3 to 5 years, and probably longer than that in having a touchless environment. I mean, if you jump on a Qantas or Virgin plane in Australia now, you can effectively get on and off the plane with your bags and not really interact with a single person that belongs to the airline or really the airport. I think we're going to probably start to see that moving forward in a lot of hotels. I think people are going to be much more comfortable with the idea of using their phones to access their room, the ability to self-manage your accounts and interact on a lighter touch with a number of employees. So I'm expecting that technology investment to really drive some increasing ease of access to hotel facilities. And I think consumers are really going to gel with that. I think we've seen that across all the tourism spectrum. Those that have invested in technology to make it easier for customers to interact. And I know for myself, when I go to a hotel, I'd love to be able to know what the room was, that I've got the key, and then it's available to me as soon as I land in the destination or when that's going to take place. And for a lot of hotels, it's in managing that investment over a period of time. What we're going to see now is that imperative is going to be in place. People are going to demand that and expect that, and hotels are going to have to deliver it.
Right. I mean, the other big concern for the hotel industry, I mean, Australian tourism industry is going to take a major hit. And there's all sorts of predictions that a whole lot of businesses are going to go bust as a result. Where do you see the hotel industry travelling on this?
Well, we're forecasting a recovery rate towards the end of the year, moving into March 2021, of around about 50% of what we were pre-COVID levels. If I look at the global aviation forecasting data, which really is the first evidence of movement in the tourism industry, they're expecting a three-year recovery globally. So what we'd expect to see in the domestic industry is that we can maybe move to a 50 to 60% rate by the end of 2021. If we're lucky, some areas will probably do better and be in the 70 to 80%, and that will be in regional areas, and that's where we'll be. But our cities are absolutely bound by the success of international tourism. So until those borders are reopened, our CBD hotels are going to have a harder operating environment than those in the regions.
Right, okay. But the regional hotels will pick up more. But do you see some of the hotels could be put out of business by this?
I think it is possible. I don't think any business is safe in this environment. We've already seen a number of owners of hotels already entered liquidation or bankruptcy proceedings over the last couple of weeks. With hopefully the announcement of JobKeeper extension, we're hoping that that will hold a lot of hotels together. But we've got, I think there's been about 400 hotels across Australia already closed their doors, according to our data company, STR. We're not expecting that to increase dramatically. But what we may see is new investment in hotels start to slow. We were coming into a record opening a couple of years with hotels, and that may start to slow, or the owners of those assets will start to look at whether hotels versus residential or commercial will be the right place for them.
Right. So do you see the business model for hotels changing as a result of this?
I don't see the overall business model changing fundamentally, because we've had 15, 20 years of the unprecedented growth globally. What I do see is the customer experience and the customer journey in those hotels changing. And what we may see is some of those niche hotels really start to find their mark in this environment. I think we're going to see that across that mid-tier sector. I think it's going to be those that innovate and adapt, bring in a whole bunch of value that is perceived by the customer, are going to do very well during this time.
So we could see some major changes for the better in the hotel industry.
Yeah, I think so. For me, the customer is going to be in an unprecedented position to request and demand different activities. We all know one of the greatest things about a hotel is making sure that you have a fantastic buffet, and those of us love a good buffet, that make sure you get your omelettes, your pastries, all the great things you want. But we're probably going to see some tweaks to that. What that looks like, time will tell. And as I said, I think we're going to see a change in the way that we engage with the employees of those hotels as well. For a positive. As I said, I think a lot of hotels have to balance that investment in technology. Now it's going to be an absolute paramount moving forward.
Well, Dean, it's been fascinating talking to you, and we'll watch the hotel industry with great fascination. Thank you very much for your time.
Great to be on with you. Cheers.
And now let's talk to RMIT Professor Sinclair Davidson.
Sinclair, we had a economic statement from the government this week, and it had a record deficit of $184.5 billion. Debt to exceed $850 billion and unemployment to go up to 9.2%, possibly more. What's your assessment of it?
The bad news is that I think the economic crisis is just starting. The good news is that I think the government have responded probably reasonably appropriately, and we're probably well placed to be a lot better off than otherwise might have been the case. So those are horrific numbers, but nonetheless, the story is could have been worse, which I think right now people don't necessarily want to hear. But yes, so if you look back to the MyEFO, which came out in December, so what, just 7 months ago, in the MyEFO, the government was forecasting a cash surplus of $5 billion. And yesterday they forecast, this is for 1920, they forecast a deficit of $85 billion. So we're actually looking here at a $90 billion turnaround in just 6 months, which kind of says to us the scale of the government's intervention. And this year going forward, they're looking at a deficit of $184 billion. Now, I kind of think that must be the biggest budget deficit outside of wartime that Australia has ever seen. So these are big, big numbers, but bearing in mind things could always have been worse. And I think the government is working quickly to do what it can, given the information that they have available to them.
It would suggest, though, that there's not going to be any quick turnaround from there's not going to be any snapback on this.
Look, I don't think there's going to be a snapback. Unfortunately, if you have a look at the government's economic statement from yesterday, they are actually forecasting a snapback. And if you have a look at some of their diagrams, I think particularly chart 2.1, it's almost like they're suggesting the snapback is on already, which I don't believe to be true. Because quite honestly, you can't just switch an economy on and off. An economy is not an electrical appliance where you switch it off at the wall and it stops and you switch it on again at the wall and all of a sudden it's running just as well as it was before. And we like to have these machine analogies for the economy, but in actual fact, the economy is not a machine. The economy is more like an interlinked web of people and their expectations and their business relationships and their purchasing behavior and what have you. And that has been dramatically disrupted by all of this. So we have some people who are working as normal. Some people are actually working harder than what they were before. We have other people who are sitting at home. And so in actual fact, we've had a massive disruption to the economy. And the snapback hypothesis simply assumes that we're all going to wake up one morning. We are going to get out of our pajamas that we've been wearing for the last 4 or 5 months. We're going to squeeze ourselves back into our business clothes because more or less all we've been doing is sort of eating and drinking. We're going to give up our day drinking and we're going to become just as productive as we were 6 months ago. We're going to literally just pick up where we were. And of course, we all know full well that you just simply cannot just pick up from where you were. Many people's suppliers have gone out of business. Many business relationships are broken. Many people have lost their jobs. So I actually think there's going to be a much slower recovery. Now, there's all these different shapes. So people talk about a V-shaped recovery or a U-shaped recovery or a W-shaped recovery. Heaven forbid we have an L-shaped recovery. But the bottom line is that the economic problems facing Australia now are that we have borrowed a lot of money and spent a lot of money already just keeping people at home. What we've got to do in future is we've actually got to get people back to work. We've got to get the economy humming again. We have also got to pay back the debt that we've accumulated in the last 6 months, an astonishing amount of debt that government have had to borrow. And I'm normally very strong on debt and deficits. I don't blame the government at all for the amount of money they've had to borrow. You simply cannot send people home without money. And so what has happened is the government have had to borrow an astonishing amount of money just to make sure that people at home can put food on the table. Other countries in the world, people are experiencing food riots. We haven't had that just yet. I think the amount of money that's been borrowed has been important to maintain Australia's social fabric. And so I don't blame them. I don't judge them for having done what they've done. But I do think the economic crisis is still coming. We've still got to get people back to work. We've still got to get jobs going. We've got to pay off the debt. And we've also got to restore our prosperity to what it was in February of this year.
Well, the issue, though, too, is, I mean, you've got the Reserve Bank saying, look, go ahead and add to the spending, increase the deficit. And you've got corporate leaders are now saying, look, just record deficits. Move on because there's no policy alternative.
Yes. Yes. Right now, there is no other alternative to more or less keep borrowing and keep spending. Unfortunately, a lot of people are rolling out their pet projects. So the argument is, you know, we should now spend more money on infrastructure projects and shovel-ready projects and all these ideas that we always have as if we were in a regular recession. This is not a regular recession. This is a very different thing that was ever happened ever before. Normally, what has happened, you know, when the economy goes into recession, there's all sorts of problems beforehand. The Australian economy was not obviously facing difficulty in January, February of this year. We had bushfires and what have you, but that is not an obvious structural problem with the economy. So there weren't structural problems with the economy in January, February. We've actually simply just had the government do something completely different. It was actually try to shut down the economy and then to try and open it up again. Now, this was to maintain social distancing, which is a public health policy. So we've actually not had an economic dislocation per se. We've actually have another policy that's called economic costs. The amount of money we've paid for right now is to cover those costs. What going forward is to actually get the economy going again. We don't have a spending problem. We actually have a get things going problem. So the government, rather than just spend money willy-nilly, they should actually be focusing on job creation. Now, job creation means that more or less monetary policy doesn't have much of a role here. If you were looking at the newspapers during the week, everybody was very excited about the Reserve Bank governor's speech earlier on in the week. Don't want to be horrible about the Reserve Bank governor, but right now he's almost more or less redundant because there's no role for monetary policy right now. You can lower interest rates to zero. I mean, I think they're at 0.25 now or something ridiculous. They've been pushing on that piece of string for a decade. Nothing's happened. So the Reserve Bank governor has got an interesting opinion and what have you, but in terms of what the Reserve Bank does, there's not much to be done there. Similarly, fiscal policy in terms of building roads and dams and all these big infrastructure projects that the people always talk about, I wouldn't be doing that. Right now, they're giving money to people to spend because they're not earning anything. They should keep doing that. But what they need to do is actually make it easier to employ people. They make it easier to start up businesses. They need to make it easier to invest. Unfortunately, if you look at the update yesterday, the government are still forecasting declines in investment. The only increase in investment comes from the mining industry, where they are now replacing depreciated assets. So Australia went into the crisis with a low investment problem. We've got to fix that. We went into the crisis with a low productivity problem. We've got to fix that. And there's a great article today by the man from Deloitte, in the financial, Chris Richardson, in the Financial Review, more or less saying, we've got to increase the speed limit at which the economy can grow. We are not going to solve our debt and deficit problem by austerity. We are not going to solve our debt and deficit problem by increasing taxes. The only way that we can do it right now is by growing the economy. We have to grow the economy by creating private sector employment opportunities. That's the way going forward. And because the public sector have lost no jobs. The private sector has lost the jobs. We've got to recreate those jobs in the private sector using private expectations and what have you. So this is not a build more roads solution. This is actually entrepreneurs have got to be able to go and start new businesses, re-employ people.
In effect, what you're saying is what we need is some microeconomic reform.
Yes. Yes, yes. The normal macroeconomic tools that we deploy for getting out of recessions are not appropriate right here. We actually need lots of micro reform. And unfortunately, too many people start with micro reform thinking this is all about IR. I mean, yes, there are always IR reform issues to be thought about, but I would be looking at business regulation. I would be looking at red tape. I would be looking at beige tape. I'd be looking at green tape. Making it easier to start businesses and not necessarily making it easier to pay your employees less. And that's what people always think of microeconomic reform as, oh, you know, we're going to screw the workers. This is not a time for this. This is actually a time to enhance the opportunities to create jobs throughout the Australian economy. And that should be the focus here.
Right. Okay. So what you're saying is we need a period of microeconomic reform that we haven't seen since, what, the 80s?
The 80s, definitely. But to be fair to the government, some of that microeconomic reform is occurring already. So, for example, governments very quickly suspended payroll tax.
Yes.
Now, for years and years and years, people have been saying payroll tax is a tax on jobs, and governments have been saying, oh, we don't know, we're not sure, maybe not. Almost straight away, payroll tax was suspended. So that should be made permanent. Because it just says the governments knew all along that it was a problem, but it was something we could afford. Mm. A lot of things like payroll tax, like green tape, like beige tape, are things we can't really afford anymore. You know, we were a lot richer in February. We're actually a lot poorer now. It's not obvious that we're poor, but we're actually a lot poorer now than what we were just 6 months ago. And we can't afford the regulatory state that we had 6 months ago. And as I said, to be fair to government, they have reacted very quickly on obvious things. But there's obviously a lot more work to be done.
Well, Sinclair, it'll be fascinating to watch. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
So what's happening in the news? Well, fear, US-China tensions, and cheap money have lifted the gold price to an all-time high. Gold has raced to a record high as the US's deepening COVID-19 crisis sent the US dollar tumbling further and encouraged nervy investors to choose the precious metal as a place to park their cash. The price of the metal, used by investors as a store of value in times of stress, climbed as much as 2.4% to a record $1,944.73 a troy ounce, blasting past its previous nominal high at $1,921, set in September 2011. Gold has rallied by more than a quarter this year, making it one of the best-performing mainstream assets, as investors brace for the economic fallout of COVID-19 and seek to minimise the effects of a sweeping central bank interventions on their portfolios. Investors think the fundamentals are in place for gold to challenge US$2,000 an ounce later this year. Throwing mounting geopolitical tensions between the US and China, the vox populi risk of mounting social disorder playing out in the US and Europe, and the nosedive in the value of the world's reserve currency in gold looks like a no-brainer. ASX-listed gold miners have been among the best beneficiaries of the rally, which translates the gold price to $2,707 an ounce in Australian dollar terms. And second quarter CPI fell 1.9% quarter-on-quarter. Economists have been expecting a 2% quarter-on-quarter fall. Year-on-year, CPI fell 0.3%. Economists had been expecting a 0.5% drop. And Melbourne businesses are bracing for an extension to the city's six-week lockdown and a deeper economic slump as COVID-19 cases across the state continue to spike to record levels. Prominent Melbourne businessman Graham Samuel, who gave a series of speeches 2 months ago in which he said the authorities handled the pandemic reasonably well and predictions of an 8% employment rate had merit. On Monday, he said he'd now revise his view. Bad news for landlords. The latest CoreLogic data shows rent values declined nationally 0.3% in the month of June and 0.5% over the quarter. This was the largest quarterly fall in rent since September 2018, and further falls are expected in the coming months. Capital city rents have been more immediately impacted by the negative economic shock resulting from COVID-19. Capital city rents fell 0.7% in the June quarter, compared with a 0.2% rise in rents across regional Australia. And the 2020 COVID depression continues. ANZ Roy Morgan Australian Consumer Confidence fell for the fifth week straight. Sentiment is down 10% from its end of May high. Case numbers in Victoria and New South Wales seem to be sapping confidence, as is September's reductions in JobKeeper and JobSeeker. And Australia is in danger of marking its first three quarters of economic contraction since the 1982 recession, as Victoria's virus lockdown threatens to last beyond its six-week schedule, stalling the national jobs and spending recovery despite a surge in government stimulus payments. In the week to July 11th, 1.4% of Victorian jobs were cut, according to tax office payroll figures released on Tuesday, driving a 0.6% national fall and reversing some of the gains from May to the end of June as the economy started to reopen. If translated into the separate Australian Bureau of Statistics labour force survey, the payroll numbers indicate that 60,000 or so of the national 210,000 jobs recovered in June are now being lost again. On the same basis, Victoria has now lost about 252,000 jobs since March. With another 380 virus COVID-19 cases in Victoria on Tuesday, economists expect the chances of an easing in restrictions after the original six-week timeframe have been blown, and that could send the September quarter economic growth number into negative territory. And Victoria's and New South Wales' poor responses to the coronavirus health crisis has paved the way for smaller states to turbocharge their economic growth. Commonwealth Bank's latest quarterly State of the States report reveals Victoria has lost the title of best performing state economy for the first time in 2 years. That honour has instead been claimed by Tasmania, which tied for first place with Victoria in the last report. It's the first time since September 2009 that the island state has taken top spot on its own. Tasmania ranked first in four of the eight economic measures used by the bank on a relative basis. Those measures were unemployment, population growth, retail trade and business investment, relative to the state's decade average. And the cost of paid pandemic leave for the aged care sector could escalate quickly due to the low bar for workers to self-isolate, centres have warned. Residential aged care centres and nursing agencies demanded the Morrison government increase its funding for the sector to pay for the two-week entitlement approved by the Workplace Tribunal this week and expected to come into effect on Wednesday. The employers argued the paid leave, accessible any time a worker has to self-isolate, is unviable and risks the supply of critical staff. And Scott Morrison has broadened the membership of the business advisory body assisting the government with COVID-19 recovery, but has made it clear the group will be advising the cabinet, which means much of their input will remain confidential. The Prime Minister said the COVID-19 Commission, which he established at the beginning of the pandemic to help keep things moving in the economy when supply chains were severely disrupted, was set to morph into an advisory board that could work inside the government. It will be reconfigured to advise the government on its job-maker agenda for the post-pandemic recovery, with former top unionist Paul Howes to join the team of commissioners. The COVID-19 Commission was set up in the early outbreak, led by former Fortescue Metals Chief Executive Nev Power, to coordinate with business to deal with logistic issues. It will now advise the Prime Minister on a range of reforms, including on industrial relations, federation reform and infrastructure. And the Productivity Commission has warned younger people that they face the fight of their lives to find their dream job and pay because of the long-term consequences of the virus-induced recession. The Commission's paper, titled Climbing the Jobs Ladder, Slower, Young People in a Weak Labour Market, investigated the scarring in the job market in the 10 years after the global financial crisis. It showed that from 2008 to 2018, young people had more difficulty getting jobs in the occupations they aspired to, and if they started in a less attractive occupation, it was harder for them than before 2008 to climb the occupation ladder. The Productivity Commission spells out how young people who take on an occupation lower on the jobs ladder due to the economic downturn will likely earn lower salaries for an extended period. The report showed the 2008 global financial crisis caused a weak labour market for a decade and warns we may be in for a similar or worse time frame. In June, the jobless rate for 20 to 24-year-olds was 13.9%. The Productivity Commission report found that by mid-April, job losses for people under 20 was around 23%, but by the end of June, this had reduced to around 5%. The study used the Household Income and Labour Dynamics in Australia dataset to show that young people found work in lower scored occupations as based on the alignment between a person's education with their earning potential. The likelihood of transitioning to better outcomes was also low and worsened slightly over time, suggesting that poor initial outcomes can have long-term effects on one's occupation. Those aged 20 to 34 experienced nearly zero growth in real wage rates from 2008 to 2018, and workers aged 15 to 24 experienced a large decline in full-time work and an increase in part-time work. In his speech at the National Press Club last Friday, Treasurer Josh Frydenberg warned there could be complications for young people trying to get jobs and or pay rises. And policies to create jobs will take priority over calls for faster tax cuts in the next phase of the Morrison government's economic stimulus, amid a political fight over the cost of bringing forward $48 billion in personal tax relief. Prime Minister Scott Morrison declared nothing else mattered to his policy plan as much as measures to create new jobs or keep people in work, sending a warning signal to Liberals who want faster tax cuts. The government has legislated personal tax cuts in three stages, with the second stage starting in 2022 and the third in 2024, leading some government MPs to call for a change to the timetable to give the economy a boost. A worker with a taxable income of $80,000 would receive a $1,080 tax cut for the second stage, while a worker on $200,000 would receive a $2,565 tax cut. The Greens and social services groups have attacked the idea of bringing forward the personal income tax cuts on the grounds this would help those lucky enough to have jobs and would not create new. And if you're a bank shareholder, don't expect a dividend. The Prudential Regulator has instructed banks to reduce payout ratios to below 50% for the rest of the calendar year. In a letter to banks, Australian Prudential Regulation Authority Chairman Wayne Burs tells the banks to moderate payments to shareholders in light of the many demands the virus crisis is placing on bank capital. The edict will have an immediate impact on the hip pockets of millions of shareholders who buy the banks for dividends, with most Australian banks regularly paying out between 80% and 95% of their annual profits annually. And Australia ranks last in manufacturing self-sufficiency among the world's developed economies, with a new report showing the nation uses $565 billion worth of manufacturing output annually, but produces only $380 billion. As the COVID-19 pandemic highlights problems with global supply chains and gaps in Australia's manufacturing capability, the report released by the Australian Centre for Future Work shows renewal of the sector could generate as much as $180 billion in new sales, $50 billion in additional GDP, and more than 400,000 jobs. It blames failures of trade and industrial policy for undermining domestic manufacturers' success in doing business with key global markets, producing dangerously lopsided patterns in overseas trade. Manufacturing jobs make up about 6.9% of Australia's workforce, but more than 26.4% of all research and development spending. Total employment in the sector has dropped by 9.6% since 2010, the report shows. And Australia's horror summer bushfires have put climate change at the forefront of risk factors for Australian mining companies, according to accounting and consulting firm KPMG. In the firm's 2021 Australian Mining Risk Outlook, KPMG mining risk partner Karen Sugars said that bushfires, which swept across both sides of the country over summer, pushed business risks associated with climate change to the top of the thinking of Australian mining executives taking part in its annual survey. The primary research for the KPMG study was conducted in January, as the impacts of the coronavirus pandemic were just beginning to emerge. But Ms. Sugars said that while subsequent contact with senior mining executives had highlighted the impacts of the pandemic, the Australian sector had been well prepared to cope with its threat from a health and safety perspective, but was now looking more closely at the wider ramifications of similar threats. And Saputo will drop the Coon name from its popular cheese products in Australia, the latest company to change branding amid a corporate reckoning on systemic racism. The Canadian food giant is working to develop a new brand name that will honour the brand affinity felt by our valued customers while aligning with current attitudes and perspectives, it said in a statement posted online. The company says its cheese brand was named after founder Edward William Coon, but the word Coon is more popularly recognised as a racist term with its roots in American slavery, an abbreviation of the word raccoon used to caricature some black people, according to the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia at Ferris State University in Michigan. Saputo's move follows mounting pressure on corporations to remove racist branding as protests flared in the US and elsewhere against George Floyd's death at the hands of police. A slew of companies and groups have changed their problematic brand names, including the Washington NFL team, which dropped Redskins, and country music group Lady Antebellum, which changed its name to Lady A. This month, Unilever removed the word fair from the name of skin whitening cream it sold in India for decades. PepsiCo's Aunt Jemima pancake mix, Colgate-Palmolive's Darlie toothpaste, and Mars' Uncle Ben's Nice brand have all pledged to ditch the racist tropes in their branding. And Metcash has accelerated the consolidation of the Australian tool and hardware industry with the acquisition of a 70% stake in Total Tools for $57 million. Total Tools is a franchisor to the largest tool retail network in Australia with 81 bannered stores, which generated sales of $555 million in the 12 months to December 2019. Metcash's strategy is to have a mix of independently owned and joint venture retail stores. It can move to 100% ownership within the next 4 years. Metcash will provide a $35 million debt facility to Total Tools to support its growth plans. Metcash owns a Mitre 10 and Home Timber and Hardware brands. The deal is subject to approval by the Australian Competition Consumer Commission. The deal comes after Bunnings received approval from the Competition Watchdog for its acquisition of Adelaide Tools, a specialist tool and power equipment provider. And more than 800 passengers have joined a class action against the operators of the Ruby Princess over its handling of the coronavirus outbreak. The cruise ship, docked in Sydney in March, allowed 2,647 passengers to disembark, despite some showing flu-like symptoms. The ship came to be linked to hundreds of COVID-19 cases and more than 20 deaths. Shine lawyers announced a class action on Friday, alleging the company failed in their duty of care, while a New South Wales Special Commission of Inquiry is also underway. An infant formula group, Bubs Australia, is expanding into the vitamin sector with a new range of children's products called VitaBubs, and has signed up international model Jennifer Hawkins as the front person for the brand, which will be sold in pharmacy giant Chemist Warehouse from October. But the core Bubs range of goat's milk infant formula products has experienced a slowdown in Australia in the June quarter, with revenues falling by 15% as the Diageo trade in China was disrupted by heavy cutbacks in flights to China and logistics problems. Bubs chief executive Christy Carr said Bubs had been working on its expansion in the vitamin sector for 12 months and was eyeing the rising number of children taking vitamins. She said Jennifer Hawkins, a former Miss Universe and television personality who had an eight-month-old baby herself, was the ideal person to be the ambassador to the VitaBubs brand. Ms Carr said Ms Hawkins had 1.8 million followers on social media and would be paid an undisclosed fee, which she could choose to take in cash or shares under the three-year deal. And the managing director of Australia's oldest and largest investment company has described the impact of the coronavirus as worse than the global financial crisis, after reporting a 41% decline in profit and being forced to draw on reserve to make up the final dividend. Australian Foundation Investment Company's Managing Director Mark Freeman said the impact of the virus crisis on everything from everyday routines to global economies felt more challenging than the GFC, where the financial system was just a few wrong moves from a catastrophe. This feels more broad-based. It's global and affecting the economy in a broader way. There are not too many industries that have been spared, Mr. Freeman said. And that's it for this week. And next week I'll be talking to Lyndall Spooner, the founder and director of consultancy and advisory firm Fifth Dimension. She'll be talking about how business leaders now need to adopt a wartime mindset. And I'll be talking to IFM Investors Chief Economist Alex Joyner about the government's response to the pandemic-induced recession. In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter at TalkingBizBowZ, on Facebook and on LinkedIn. And if you want, leave a comment. Wishing you all a safe and healthy week and looking forward to bringing you Talking Business next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.